حفظ. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته. And السلام عليكم to your listeners.
Okay, let's start with Jordan. Now, Jordan is insisting that there's been a violation of international law at Masjid al-Aqsa. What's happened for the statement to be made?
Yes, Jordan is very strongly denouncing what they call the Israeli occupation forces' arrest of one of the imams of Masjid al-Aqsa, Imam Sheikh Mohammed Salim. And this was after the Jumu'ah Salah this past Friday. He was arrested just as he left Masjid al-Aqsa, and he was accused by the IOF of incitement in his khutbah that was delivered at Masjid al-Aqsa. What happened thereafter is people on the ground were very frustrated and disillusioned and very wary of how this would be handled. It's very reminiscent of what took place during the first and second intifada, when many of the khatibs, many of the imams, many of the shuyukh were imprisoned in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, both in what we call Palestine 1948, the Arab Israelis as they refer to, as well as those of course in West Bank, Ramallah and Gaza, etc., but especially those within the old city of Jerusalem. In recent times, scholars have not been very easily imprisoned by virtue of law or of people of the outcry, and even from external forces of pressure like the United States, who urges Israel not to be very much more careful in how they handle issues such as this. The imam was taken in and was kept in for a few hours. Immediately, Jordan's news agencies carried the story. The Minister of Awqaf and Islamic Affairs, Hay al-Dawood, he expressed Jordan's rejection. He denounced the Israeli occupation authority to arrest what he said was a cleric performing his religious duties. He also described the detention of the imam, which was a few hours long, as, I quote, an interference in the mosque's affairs. He also said that the ministry has followed up on the detention of the imam and are following through on the story to see what happens. There was an international press briefing about what happened. And again, it's reminiscent of what did take place over 10 years ago. A reminder that Jordan itself, the Jordanian Hashemite leadership, the monarchy, is the custodian of Islamic and Christian holy sites in East Jerusalem and Amman, and they're the ones who appoint the waqf officials at Al-Haram Al-Sharif. So one wonders why this would be the case or why this would happen. And there is one reason that seems to be circulating of why this has happened possibly. It's very close to the Passover that will begin April 22nd and end April 30th. So as we do draw closer to the Jewish holidays and festivals, there always is a much tighter ring of security and unnecessary detention for Palestinians and the Musallis as well. We can perhaps unfortunately expect something more along these lines in the coming days leading up to the Jewish Passover.
Now, moving on to Egypt and Saudi Arabia, King Salman's visit to Egypt, is the cementing of ties between the two countries? It has been all over the news for the last few days.
Yes, it has indeed. I mean, we're seeing the signing of over 20 agreements, memorandums of understanding, and this is in the wake of Saudi and Egypt establishing a fund where they're going to invest. They have an investment of a capital of about 60 billion Saudi riyals. It was signed by the Deputy Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, by Egypt's Ministry of Investment, and so they're hoping to set up a free economic zone in the Sinai Peninsula. Wonders how much of this will follow through or carry through, considering that Sinai itself is one of the hotbeds of conflict in the region itself. Pretty much when the rest of Egypt is calm, we find that Sinai always has some type of tension or conflict. Very close to Gaza itself, so again one wonders what's the role of this free economic zone. We're also looking at perhaps, we understand that there's going to be construction of roads and development, but what about in terms of safety and military zone as well? While it is going to be a free economic zone, how does this affect the military relationship between the two countries? And it seems from the agreement and the draft agreements and the MOUs that is going to be as well affecting the military power and prowess of Saudi Arabia in Egypt itself, specific to the Sinai. We know that Egypt in recent years has always been calling out on what they call bigger powers in the region and abroad to assist them, to help them uproot and remove all of the tension that is happening in the Sinai itself. It will be interesting to see how Israel themselves respond to this, because they have always mentioned and cautioned about the unrest in the Sinai itself. We then have Egypt's Grand Mufti, who made a statement as well, Grand Mufti Sheikh Ibrahim Alam, and he said that the strong and positive relationships between Egypt and Saudi Arabia can help them now work against terrorism and to combat challenges in the region. We do know that Egypt has always relied on a power within the Middle East itself, and while the Gulf countries seem to have moved away and sidestepped, it's Saudi Arabia is the only one who stepped up to the plan and to work together with Egypt. This all on the heels of the joint Arab force that's announced they're going to combat terrorism. On a final note, together with all the MOUs signed and all the draft agreements and paperwork and documentation done, there was also Saudi Arabia's what they call a gift to Egypt. It's something we spoke about a few years ago when it was already being planned and announced, and perhaps as a recap of it, that King Salman laid the foundation stone of the Ba'uth Islamic City. It will include a dormitory that can house up to 30,000 students. And he prayed Salah at Masjid Al-Azhar Masjid, and then was briefed about how the Masjid is going to be restored and how this entire area is going to be better suited and facilitated for students, especially foreign students, and how it's going to be part of this upliftment of Cairo itself, a municipality as well. There were talks and discussions with the Coptic Orthodox Pope as well. That was the first that Saudi's king discussed with them. So there's an opening of communication and networks, interfaith, political and military wise. Of course, human rights didn't feature anywhere on this topic for two countries who hold some of the poorest records of human rights.
What's in all of this for Saudi? We know they are struggling. The war in Yemen has cost them a lot of money. The oil prices are very low. What do they gain in the long term?
In the long term, they gain perhaps a relationship that can be soldered with Russia itself. We know that Egypt, from its past, going back 40 years ago, has a very strong relationship with Russia. And Russia emerging as a power of the world to be reckoned with. Saudi Arabia, and especially the recent current monarchy rulers, seem to realize that they cannot bank on or rely only on the United States itself, and so seem to be trying to edge further towards Egypt. It's known from history and diplomatic ties in the past that whoever is closer to Egypt does benefit from some type of relationship with Russia itself. As you rightly mentioned, Saudi Arabia, as it stands now, has spent billions on the Yemen issue, which is now currently under ceasefire, as we hear, but there is a need for them to solder and to strengthen relationships with others in the region. Beyond all of this diplomatic and political paperwork, it really is about military prowess in the region, where Saudi Arabia wants to establish itself, and Egypt, that's now tarnished itself with its horrific human rights issue and status, would like to have a partner next to them. So it works well for both of the countries, both with tarnished images and both seeking to be powers in the region, and perhaps realizing that in this instance they can work well together.
And finally, we know that internationally the Panama Papers dominated headlines across the globe. Anyone of note implicated in the Middle East?
Well, in the Middle East, it wasn't such a big issue or report as it was for many other regions in the world. Perhaps because so much is already happening in the Middle East all the time and continuously, people are waiting for news of ceasefire violations or otherwise. When it came to the Middle East, many of the media papers were very hush about it. Again, from countries that are monarchies, that was so much the case. And with most of the countries being despotic regimes, it made it much more difficult to talk about it. One of them that I picked up was the cousins and family of the Jordanian monarchy that was picked up. Saudi Arabia's monarchy of past as well was picked up, as well as Qatar's previous emir. That's what we pick up, but on a very subtle note, as opposed to, for example, hearing it and being splashed out in newspapers around the world. The Middle East was much more cautious in how it handled the Panama Papers leak. But we also know that people, or rather those in the ministries in Egypt were involved, as well as those particularly in telecommunications. It hasn't been something that's been followed up so closely on a wider scale when newspaper columns or articles and analysis being done for international Arabic-speaking community, then much more so. But on a local level, it's more about how they can just keep themselves afloat and alive, I think.
As always, Jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated.
You're most welcome. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was today's Middle East update with Radio Islam International's Hafidha Rehana Omar.